Good evening, all. I know some of us were not here last week or the last couple of weeks, but I was wondering if anybody here took the time to listen to any of the talks or read any of the material. So, are people who haven't attended a little familiar, at least fleetingly familiar, with what we're discussing? That's very important.
And I have a few extra copies of the retext. Does everyone has that, right? He printed it out, I think.
I could use one, Emily.
Yeah. I thought on the way here.
It's all right. Actually, I think it's really important that we could look at, before we go, we're dealing with something called the absolute slogans. And we've been on this kind of journey already in terms of exploring a path. We've been exploring it from pretty much the beginning in terms of trying to understand the nature of suffering, the nature of confusion, the nature of understanding the need to know our minds and to learn how to basically actually see and accept and understand our own basic sanity, discover this. So, you know, this is what we've been doing for a while. And so I just thought, because I would like to know, I would like to actually just hear if anybody has been employing any of these slogans so far. if you would be willing to share that with us, and any kind of comments or concerns that arose, because I think before we go forward, we need to really sort of understand where we've already supposed to have been covered. Yeah, go ahead.
I love them, but there was an interesting article in Shambhala Sun a few months ago, maybe last month. Someone picked out five of these slogans, said, these are my five top ones. And one of them is, don't ponder others.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been working with that ever since. I just think it's terrific. I mean, who needs all the others? You know, it's sort of overwhelming to read this list.
Mm.
But I keep coming back to don't ponder others. I just find it wonderfully useful. It's really good. It's happy news.
Yeah, relief. I mean, I think that's part of the deal, is actually lightening things up.
Yeah.
Did everyone get the preliminaries? That was the first thing we did. We talked about the preliminaries, or the preliminary practice. That's number one.
The four reminders.
Four reminders. Exactly.
You probably did.
These are all online.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you see that?
I did.
Okay. I wanted to share something with you. Michael brought up last week this book by Trelak Rinpoche, Lojong, is absolutely wonderful book, wonderful resource for this material. It's interesting to read different teachers speaking about the same topic. And in this case, his flavor is different, and it throws light on things in a very different way. But it can be, they're both helpful. It's not like one is better or worse than the other. It's more about just sort of rounding it out or expanding the understanding of what that could be. We also mentioned that Trungpa Rinpoche has a book, which, you know, when he introduced these the first time, really, I don't think they've been around, certainly not in circulation or in translation, called Training the Mind. That's an essential text, which, you know, brings this whole up. But I've been delighted to read the insight that Trelak Rinpoche provides, who is a really marvelous teacher who spent years steeping himself in Western thought and culture, like Trungpa Rinpoche. But I mean, he just completely threw himself into it and he became very familiar with how Westerners think and how they are different from the way Easterners, and particularly what Tibetans, think. And so he became very skillful in terms of being able to show the differences. Mm-hmm. So when we're reading a Tibetan term, we're going, well, what does this mean? Well, you know, here's what it means to Tibetans, but that isn't going to mean that to you or me. You know, we have to, like, understand we're creating our own phenomena. This is a very fundamental thing to this whole thing about what we call absolute slogans. We create the phenomena we live in. Now, that sounds like a big deal. But fundamentally, it's actually quite simple. So as we learn more about that, it's easier to take responsibility for our experience than not. It's much easier not to be hanging it onto other people, even though we inherit and we are, you know, certainly informed and affected by other people, situations, genes, karma, the whole thing. So very important. Anyway, if anybody is interested, you can. I can give you more information on this.
I have a question about the number two slope. Mm-hmm. I tried to work with it.
You want to just for everybody's sake that's all phenomena regarding
regard all dhammas as dreams. Mm-hmm. And I read what Pema Chodron said, and I kept reading it and thinking about it. And she sort of said, "Lighten up, don't worry." Sort of, it's not all so real. And I had a hard time trying to figure out, like, I can kind of see where, like, the petty day-to-day things, you're like, well, it's just not a big deal, let it go. Like, don't. But then I was like, well, where's that line where you say, like, this really matters? Like, you know, if people are really cruel to each other, should I get bothered? Or just, oh, it's just, it's all whatever. And it's like, where's that line between let it go and care about it?
And what did you find out?
I couldn't tell. I didn't know, and I couldn't tell. I mean, I didn't think she was saying there's nothing you should care about and try to make different. But I couldn't. I guess I couldn't quite tell. Like, do you have to figure out that line for yourself?
Yes. We always have to figure things out for ourselves, don't we?
Yeah, right. But I'm just saying, but I...
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, let me see if I can be coherent about this. I'm just wondering if it's all about awareness, right? And so we're in it, whatever it is, you know, the caring, the despairing, the whatever, and then we're out of it, you know, like it's because we're humans on the planet. How can we help but just like with sitting on the cushion, thoughts are going to come, are going to go, life is going to happen, it's going to continue in one direction, then it's going to change. It's the same, I think, it's the same thinking, is that there are going to be things that I'm going to get riled up about and care, and then, you know, I'm going to also see that, that was something that I put some form of attachment on, and that's okay. And then it doesn't have to be, or it can continue. I don't know if I'm really making any sense.
So the question really is here. We have this problem in which we will be going into actually, as we discuss what's called emptiness. We have this potential problem. Emptiness is considered basically the absolute. But you know, if you basically solidify emptiness, if like you get stupider than if you really believe all this stuff is real. If you really believe the emptiness is real, and you can get really poisoned by it. Because you just go, you know, what difference does it make? I'll just sort of roll on the floor or something because, you know, what's the difference, right? I mean, I've had people tell me this before, and I've actually gone through these kind of experiences too about just, well, what difference does it make if it's all zero, you know? And I think that that's why, you know, we're balancing the relative and the absolute. We need to understand they are together. Your concern about humanity or well-being of others and the concern about the planet, all of these concerns, your concern about just genuine care for others at all is a fundamentally good thing. And, you know, so this is not a threat to dissolve all of that. Mm-hmm. It's basically helping you understand that, you know, no matter what, I mean, we're all in this kind of big stew pot. And the stew pot is not something that's solid. It's like everybody says it's like this, it's like that. But, you know, it's all just what we're making up. And it's a question of what we agree on. Does that mean that only means that we agree on it? It doesn't mean that it actually has some kind of validity beyond that. The ultimate validity is beyond the mind, and that was actually what Michael introduced last week when he asked us to flash ultimate bodhicitta. I don't know how many of us, I would like to ask if any of us would, you know, try to do that in this last week, if anybody did that or had any moments of attempting to do that. Do you remember the actual instructions for that, how we went through that? Do we want to do it again? Let's do it again, because I think, Michael, I'm going to let you give the instructions, old boy. Okay.
Look, the last time Emily gave the instructions, okay.
You made me do it.
Oh, that's right, okay. Well, either one of you.
No, I think you do it.
Mike, it's your turn, yeah.
Let's brighten up. Relax. Look out, not at a particular person, but go straight level out with your eyes. And the basic technique, the basic thing is neither to use the technique, such as focusing on the breath. In other words, there's nothing to focus on. At the same time, be present. So, the word flash was used, but then someone thought that that meant that something goes pop, but it doesn't. It's as simple as it can be. It's just be here without effort and without wandering to the best we can. So let's just do that.
So, when we do that, that's called meditation without support. You're just here, or there, whatever you want to call it. You're not using your breath as a support or any kind of reminder. You're just completely being present, and it can be very momentary. And you don't want to strain. You don't want to push it. So often it's good to do it in very short spurts, so you can start to develop a familiarity. I read a quote from Kensei Rinpoche the other day, which I thought was pretty relevant to this. And this is basically going to be the same thing. He says, recognizing the empty, non-existent, insubstantial nature of ego is meditation on absolute bodhicitta. So basically what we're learning about is that in that moment when we are flashing on ultimate bodhicitta, there's nobody there. Does that make sense? Well, if you think somebody's there, you're not doing it.
Yeah.
See, it's not like, oh, I'm doing this now. It's not like some little voice saying, yes, of course, I'm flashing ultimate bodhicitta. It's just being there. When that happens, there's no reference point. We're talking about getting introduced to something called no reference point. It's really very, very simple. And, while it seems like initially requiring effort, fundamentally, as time goes on and we familiarize, we realize it's the most natural state there is.
When you're done, can I ask this question?
If it's relevant, you can bring it up now, yeah.
Doing this, is it fair to say that when your eyes blink, or if you get a pop, and let's say it's a regular event, do you think that signals the end of it, or that instantaneous pop or flash? Because last week we used the word flash, and it sounded like there was a moment that something happened.
Nothing.
No, nothing's happening.
No, now you're saying, God, there's nothing there. So that to me, that to me indicates that the flash is like the end.
No, you see, when you say flash, as Michael tried to point out, it's not like a flash bulb going off, pop, you know. You just rest. It's resting. And if your eyes blink, they blink, you know. Now, maybe the first time you go, oh, it's over. I blinked.
Yeah.
But as you do more and more, you're going to realize we all blink. This is what we do. It's completely natural to blink. We're not trying to, like, not blink.
So flash just means it's quick. It's quick.
Yeah.
It's nothing we hold on to. So we just do the technique. We look out, eyes open, drop every technique, just drop it, everything, the thought, everything. It just falls away, and you're just there. And then it's not happening. And so it's a flash, meaning it's just quick. And that's why the instruction is to do it in very short time, over and over again.
And its purpose is what?
To learn to just rest in this absolute bodhicitta. So that's why we introduce it now, because this is the way these slogans are organized.
So I can read a little bit of the notes I took from from Trolloc Rinpoche, which I thought were helpful. This is a process of resting. And, of course, you could do this when you're meditating. Just stop for a second. Oh, you know, you've been doing your thing where you're going back to your breath. And then just bingo, you know. And then you go back to working with your breath. Or back to your thoughts, depending on what you say.
That was courage.
Yeah, no, I just tried to be realistic there. So, what we actually experience, and this is what I just want to briefly mention, is we experience something called the basis. Now, we talked about the basis at the very beginning of this class, when we talked about how this is everybody, the basis is here for everybody. It is everything and it's nothing. It's nothing because our mind can't grasp it. So if we can just sort of like leave ourselves open to that, what we're doing is we're just temporarily tuning into this, tapping into it. And what we discover, or how people have described this basis, who have really worked with this and actually learned what it is it is the natural state. It's what we call wisdom mind. So when we do, grant your blessings, may my mind be done with one with the Dharma.
I'm hoping that'll happen too.
We're actually asking wisdom mind to just really be present, so you know we can do all this. That we're not talking about looking for deity or some other hidden agency out there which is going to come in and do this job for us or shower blessings. We're asking for our own fundamental wisdom mind, Buddha nature, to come through. And give us the strength. This is our own true nature we're talking about. So we're learning to familiarize with this, and it's fundamentally learning about spaciousness and luminous clarity and stability of mind. We did go through this briefly last week. So when we rest in the state, when we actually begin to familiarize with it, when we notice all these three elements are present, spaciousness, luminous clarity, and stability in itself, because we discover that's what it is, this is what we call temporary realization of absolute bodhicitta. Now, the reason why this is important is because without at least initially getting a flavor, a touch, even if it's just a passing kind of experience, like introduction, it's really hard to understand how to work with these subsequent slogans, because, you know, then it's just like we can start taking them seriously. Drive all blames into oneself. Okay, I'm going to become Jesus Christ tomorrow. I want everybody to string me up. Maybe we'll do it for Easter, you know. The penitentes, I used to live in New Mexico where they had these penitentes, and for years they would actually find someone who would volunteer to be put on a cross. And some of them have to be nailed because it was a flagellant sect. That's how they ended up where they were in New Mexico. And, you know, everybody died who did this. I mean, but that's not what we're asking. Yeah, that's not what we're asking. This is not what that's about. No martyrs. We're just talking about driving all blames into oneself as a means to sort of help to clarify the situation so that there's no blame left. Blame is the big issue. But we have to understand, the only way we can do this with any kind of degree of sanity is to understand that we have this fundamental empty nature, that there's nobody real here who's going to take all the blame and get sick and die because, you know, absolutely, because this poison that I'm taking in is real and I'm real and it's making me toxified and now I'm going to keel over. I mean, this would have not worked. This whole teaching would have died out long ago if that were what was going to happen. So, yeah.
And I think it's In This Moment is a Perfect Teacher, Kevin Chodron's series. I believe that's the one where she talks about drive all blames into one and also regard all dharmas as dreams. And when she talks about regard all dharmas as dreams, she brings up the example of a teacher who said, we could say we're just in this room sitting and meditating, but we could also say we're in a room that's on a ball that's spinning round and round in the middle of this vast, you know, in the midst of a vast universe. So that there are many different ways to tell this story, to describe what is going on here. I guess I've taken to regard all dharmas as dreams as meaning that in the ultimate, we're going to all be gone. This is all going to be, it'll be like a dream. History or space, in the realm of time and space, there's something almost dreamlike about the moment existing and about this moment on Earth existing. That's how I've looked at it.
Well, look at every generation, people are rewriting history. What's history? We create history in our mind. It keeps on being it changes. What really happened? I don't know because I'm reading interpretations. It's like the Rashomon story, you know. We don't really know what actually occurred at any given point when it keeps on being reworked over and over and over.
But it's part of something that's very vast in terms of time and space. Mm-hmm. And that's just how I think of it. So in that respect, it's not so solid.
Yeah, and that's exactly when we flash on ultimate bodhicitta, we're opening ourselves up to that vastness. It's really vast. Mm-hmm. And that's why we can't capture it or grasp it with a thought and turn it into something. Mm-hmm. We just actually are here. It's inconceivable. And you begin to realize, that's not such a tall term. Inconceivable just means being really present, you know? It's like, because it's not wordy, it's not conceptual, we don't have things hooked onto it. We're just here. It's very drastically simple. So, I don't want to take too much time, but we're doing, I appreciate everybody's participation and I want us to keep going on this. In order for us, so just quickly, again, examining the nature of unborn awareness, well, that's what we're going to find out when we do these flashes. We will basically begin to introduce to unborn awareness. And then, so now we're kind of come to a new slogan, which is self-liberate the antidote. And that actually means we go back and look at this examining the nature of unborn awareness, the previous slogan. basically, a couple of things. One is, we're letting go of looking at things as solid or real, but we realize that's also a tool, you know, to basically lighten up. It's not like a thing in itself. We're not going to turn this emptiness or this openness, this complete open state into something and then become solid or rigid about it. In other words, then it would just basically be counterproductive to have any value if it just made us it all useless. So we're looking at just recognizing that we are in a process of going forward continuously in our practice and the path. And as the path, if we engage with it, the path unfolds. And as the path unfolds, these terms that we're working with become easier to work with, they become much more familiar, and they actually become part of our world. They actually become part of what we do and how we live. So it actually becomes very workable. It's not like something is tacked. You're not imposing something on from the outside and going, okay, I'm going to become a Buddhist, and this is what I got to get in this box. You know, it's more like you get out of the box. You dismantle the box. That's something that I'd like us all to contemplate further about this examining nature of unborn awareness as we go forward with these other slogans, and begin to start to get a little familiar with the notion of, well, what does it mean? I mean, we know we can't talk about it. It's like the way it's been described as water and wetness. You can't really describe wetness unless you know water. You can't describe sweetness without knowing honey, or, you know, you actually have to taste it. You actually have to sense it or experience it for yourself. And likewise, it's like that with what we're mentioning here with the Absolute Authority of Truth. Yes.
I mean, is it something to the effect of, once you think you get it, you know, don't be so smug because there's really more to come, or there's...
Nobody's getting. We're just getting out of the way. We're getting out of the way. So, and getting out of the way is work. You know, we continue getting out of the way, and as we do that, it sort of reveals itself, as it were. But nobody gets it. They're all antidotes. That's another thing to consider. All these slogans are going to be antidotes to fundamental ego. We are basically on the road to crushing ego, or to recognizing its complete uselessness and obsolescence. That this ego, which we think is so important and has been so important and is so drilled into us, is fundamentally just a fiction. And so what we're doing with our practice is learning how to pop that fiction and really see what's here. It does take a lot of fearlessness, because the reason the ego is there is because it doesn't want to see what's here. It wants to protect itself against what it might think is out there, even though it doesn't know. So the next slogan is resting in the nature of alaya, the basis. So, okay. This is very profound. Sorry. But we're talking again about this thing called the basis, the ground.
Here it says the essence. Is it different?
No.
Okay. Just
yeah, the basis, so essence, ground. You know, you begin to see like, oh, well, they sort of throw different aspects. You reveal or focus on different aspects of the same thing. Because, you know, if you only say essence, then it's kind of an extraction, almost. That's the association we have in our language. You know, like extracting an essence, or, you know, burning everything away, and then you just get down to the core. That also could tend you to say, oh, the core. This is the core. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, I got it.
So, alaya is the basis and the essence?
Yeah, alaya is this vastness that we're tuning into when we do this flashing of bodhicitta. We're just here, we're just flashing into the presence of now. That's another way of putting it, nowness. And so there are two levels of understanding this. The first level is basically what we carry with us. And there's a word for it, vijnana, alaya vijnana. Alaya means the ground, or the basis, and vijnana means dualistic. So this is the V-I-G-N-A-N-A. I will post, on the website, just a written kind of outline of what we're going through. That way you don't have to worry about, you know, completely getting it with the notes and all, but you'll be able to just refer to it easily. So alaya vijnana is what we call basic consciousness. It's the split. I'm here, you're there, hot, cold, up, down, right, left. Everything is defined in terms of two, right? So consciousness, that's basically what we carry around with ourselves, and how we define ourselves, and how we say we're not this and we're that. We like this, we don't like that. All the things we've been sort of discussing earlier about the structure of ego. And then that's subsumed, or let's say embraced by, It's like a little bubble inside a vast space, infinite space. And this vast space, which is also our own nature, it's not something out there, is called the Alaya Jnana, J-N-A-N-A, and that's wisdom awareness. So that's the wisdom mind we're talking about. We have any questions so far with this? Is this starting to make sense? Or is it too abstract?
So we're still dealing with rest of the nature of Alaya, the essence.
Yeah.
And that there's all these different tangents of
two Alaya. Two aspects. One is, well, we talked a little bit about the eight kinds of consciousness, did we not, earlier?
A long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. We touched on it. We have it on the website, but this is considered the eighth consciousness of, so basically, we're looking at understanding how, what do we call samsara and what do we call nirvana? Well, this vastness, this super big, this vast Alaya, the wisdom mind, is actually, even though we call it wisdom mind, it's neutral. And it can go either way. It can either go into delusion, which is samsara, basically, or it can go into perfect awareness and peace, which is basically nirvana. So it has the capacity to do all of that. And what we carry in our Alaya, the kind of personal stream of stuff we have in our life, is our habitual tendencies that is what we work with when we're actually in the process of clarifying. That's what we work with when we encounter our own confusion, is basically the stuff that we have. At the same time, fundamentally, that becomes very workable when you realize your own true nature is beyond that. And you're completely capable of dealing with this. That's why you're here. That's why we're all here. We are perfectly capable of dealing with what we have. I mean, you have to have faith in that to do it. There's no question. But we are. We all say so, don't we? Okay.
So the eighth consciousness is sometimes referred to as storehouse?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like
that can help too.
Exactly. And we might put some footnotes out as we out an outline, if that'll help everybody. Because, I mean, you know, you have second and third thoughts, so I could have said this or something. Maybe we'll add a little something to the outline so you can clarify, because this is a very important point. But basically, this ground underlies the cognitive process, and it breaks it. So this basis is a Jamgon Kongtro, famous lama of 19th century Tibet, talked about it as, he just simply said, the basis, this primordial ground, is noble Buddha nature. That's how he called it. And that's what it is. It is our Buddha nature. So it's inconceivable, vast, but totally sane, completely present, always present. Never anywhere else. So there's lots to count on here. We have these other eight consciousnesses, which I don't think we have time to review tonight. But I just wanted to ask you if you want, we can go into it, or should we maybe just look at some questions if we have. Was that clear? What I've brought up so far, was that making any sense, or does it raise more questions than anything else? Feel free to share, please.
Could I ask? I have a question, I guess. It may presuppose what you've talked about, but where do you get the assumptions that this primordial, emptiness has sanity? If it's neutral, what can you say it's sane?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like, because it's simply aware, it has its own natural wisdom, and that's sanity, that's what we're talking about. So this is something we learn directly through our own experience. We don't get this from reading books. We have to actually experience this personally. You can meet teachers, or, and we're talking about realized lamas or people who really have attained some degree of enlightenment, and you begin to see how, yes, this person is emanating sanity. You know, they have a kind of unshakable quality that's just present. And they're also human beings. It's not like they're some kind of like exalted thing beyond our capacity to relate to. Completely normal.
Our mind is basically sane because it doesn't buy into anything. It won't, it can't be deceived. Any false approach, however subtle, it just isn't going to take. And that can be frightening when you encounter that in someone, because we're always trying to con each other. It can appear like a frightening blankness that someone can't. It's like someone can see through you if they can't be deceived at all.
So if I can relate to the original question, one of the earlier questions, you asked it about the injustice seen and observed in the world. Mm-hmm. Then that's trying to impose our definition of sanity onto whatever is, you know, manifesting. And the use of the word sanity is in two different ways here. And also, isn't it close to science, which is neutral? Take, for example, the phrase transformative, you know, energies. I think I've only encountered that in Buddhism, but it seems to me there's a purpose put in our use, normal use of the word sanity. There's a purpose of humanitarianism or compassion.
Scientists have.
I can't seem to go beyond what you talk about, this neutrality.
Scientists have, perhaps if they're very well trained scientists, can have a neutrality towards my understanding of science and your understanding if they're very good scientists and can get a good hunk of the ego out of the way. But do you know scientists who actually go beyond opinion altogether, who see that whatever is going on is mind? There are occasionally, but they're very, very rare.
It seems to me a different word than sanity would be better. I mean, we confuse sanity with our common sense notion of the word, or, you know, definition of it.
Right. I just wanted, when I use the term sanity, this is something from Paramita Energist. I don't think you don't encounter that term with other Buddhist teachers. It's something that he actually talked about, just encountering basic sanity. He talked about it from the get-go. When we actually sit down and do our shamatha vipassana meditation, we're actually establishing basic sanity. We're actually tapping into it. Now, the other person who would say it differently, but said it wonderfully well, was Suzuki Roshi, this Zen master who came in California. He wrote the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is a lovely book in terms of helping us understand how to work on the path. And he said, you know, when we actually meditate, this is Buddha. When you actually do meditation practice, you are Buddha. That's all. It's really simple. So it's the same thing. And when we talk about neutral here, in terms of this open space, we're not talking about something that's cold or vacuous. Because, you know, here's the difference between East and West. Mind. This is West, right? That's what we say. My mind. Easterners say, my mind, point to the heart. That's where this teaching comes from. It comes from an understanding or experience of mind being centered in the heart. So when we're talking about openness or neutrality, we're talking about how the heart thinks, what the heart does. When we actually do something stupid, I mean really tragically stupid, it's not just some kind of intellectual flaw we're making. I mean, we're making a fundamental flaw in terms of the way we work with our energy, the way we work with our being. That's a heart issue. The whole notion of ethics and morality that have been developed, when we don't think about those as laws, but rather as guidelines to help us understand how we stay true to the heart, Then that starts to make sense as opposed to a bunch of rules that are being imposed on us. So heart is really mind. And I think we have to really readjust our thinking or general understanding or association process when we're encountering Buddha Dharma, because it really comes from that point of view. It's not just a bunch of conceptual, intellectual twirlings, you know, like grinding away the mills of intellect. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that actually the intelligence of the mind is the intelligence of the heart. So it's much more profound.
And I think that intelligence comes without a storyline, too. I mean, there's no agenda or biases, right?
Well, that's the point. So actually, I could read, just to help us understand this first alia, because we really have this egoistic alia. And this is why, when we understand the nature, the essence, or the basis, is beyond that. According to the Kagyu and Nyingma traditions, the basic consciousness underlies the whole structure of our cognitive process. It can be broken down into 8 forms of consciousness. There are the 5 sense consciousness as well as the 6 consciousness, which is the seat of reflexive awareness, the center of our rational thought process. Then we have a 7th, egoistic consciousness, which is the seat of our perception. For whatever we perceive here becomes incorporated into our self-identity. So that is the thing that starts going in, poking into the, drawing stuff out of our karmic stream, baggage, and our habitual patterns, and pulling it into something called me, what I decide to associate this identity with. Finally, there is the basic consciousness, this is the 8th consciousness, which contains traces of all the memories, habitual tendencies, emotional reactions, self-perceptions, and apperceptions that have been processed by other levels of the consciousness. These traces come from the karmic imprints that result from this interaction between the 8 kinds of consciousness and determine our experience of things, thinking patterns, emotions, attitudes, and character traits. Nothing that has been processed by consciousness is wasted. It all gets retained in the form of sedimentary karmic formations, and all of these things are happening all the time. And we remain completely unaware of them. So this is what we begin to discover as we watch the workings of our mind. When we just see these things, crazy stuff pouring out of our mind, as I sit on the cushion and I'm going, why am I not checking into an insane asylum? Mm-hmm. Talk about sanity. We're sad, you know, like, this is what we're talking about. We are talking about what's actually just going on underneath all that, that churning factories of selfhood or whatever you want to call meanness, you know, that's just all talking about me, mine, this, that, according to me. You know, it's my life, my world, this, that. And, of course, it's constantly going, changing, it's constantly modifying, even though we never believe that. It has this notion that there's some kind of continuity or integrity or, you know, just basically I am who I am. The so-called me, but actually it's just not thousands of selves, thousands of little splintered little kind of twirling sparks of loose energy that have no any kind of real basis to them, and they're all being scattering, and this kind of crazy display is called me. I call it me and how I see things and what the world is according to me. So that's basically where the problem is. I mean, and at the same time, you know, we have this other beyond in ourselves. So, just finally, the mind that grasps, too, is not located anywhere externally or internally and does not exist concretely with a color or a shape. From the continuity of ego clinging, which mistakes that which isn't, that is to say, a self, for something which is, comes the 8 consciousnesses, which are like sky flowers, empty from the very beginning. So this is where the whole thing starts going off. And so what we want to do is take back, as it were, what we unwittingly, because we've been asleep, gave away. What did we give away? We gave away what just our true being, to this fiction that we carry around in us. And so this is when we talk, that's why we're talking about working on ourselves. We're not just talking about philosophy, we really talk about working on ourselves. This is a process of learning how to liberate ourselves from the fundamental problems and confusion we carry with us. And if we can do this for ourselves, we can help the world. This is the first step to actually making a contribution to the outer world and to all the sorrows and messes that is out there, is fundamentally taking care of what's right here, the seat of my perceptions. If I can do that, then I can genuinely be a help to those outside of me and be available to them, because I'm not so mixed up about who I am. I'm just getting out of the way. And then who knows what I can do? I mean, it's not like we have a big agenda what we're going to do. We're not going to save the world, but we're going to actually begin to see. And, you know, what begins to happen is that you begin to realize that this confusion is part of the actual drama that we're going through in order to wake up. So, you know, while it sounds like seems like it would be nice if we didn't have to see it all and go through it all, it's really necessary. I mean, there doesn't seem like there's any other way. Yes?
Can I sure. I think I'm seeing more of the answer to the question I asked at the beginning. So the idea if we can let go of sort of the me, my, I like, I don't like, this makes me uncomfortable stuff that we carry around, and get to this, then the wisdom mind tells us where the real problem, what's real, what we need to do. Whereas the thinking, like, I'll draw a little line between what bothers me and what really should bother me anyway. Like the people who drive too close to my car. Those are really bad things, but the people who don't like my food, they're not.
So rather than assuming the wisdom mind's just going to come along and tell you what to do.
Well, but not tell me what to do, but...
We have two elements. This is actually a good point that we have an opportunity to bring up. We have what we call in our Buddhist practice life two factors that make this whole thing work. One is prajna. Now, prajna is just the very thing we've been talking about. When we actually flash on bodhicitta, we're exercising a part of our intelligence called prajna. It's actually a faculty of the mind that can perceive reality. That is this absolute bodhicitta that we can experience when we simply flash right there. And that prajna begins to see the fundamental insubstantiality. It's also the mind that begins to, when it looks for thoughts and can't find any source, can't find any basis, can't find any space that where thoughts occupy, and by that I also mean emotions, feelings, moods, convictions, you know, all the stuff. And we can't find where it goes. That's prajna, just the looking, just the investigation and the ascertaining. So we did briefly touch on vipassana in the past and prajna. We will go further into this as we go down the road. That's one side of it. So that's the side that sees this absolute or is capable of basically getting through, piercing through, and actually seeing very sharply the nature of things. Then, at the same time, we have something else. And that's going to be what we're going to be developing with these slogans, is skillful means. So, in other words, we don't only see this grand, wonderful, transcendent now and just sort of, you know, coast along or just establish that and, you know, no problem. It's like we actually, as we begin to realize that our own confused mind with all of the problems and states of delusion that we're in, as we work on those, are actually giving us the empowerment and the tools to actually skillfully address what it means to be in the world authentically. So the tools actually come from actually a process of transforming or breaking down the walls of ego. What are we doing on time here? So does that make sense? Prajna and skillful means. Think of these. This is going to be something we'll come back to again and again as we go forward. And it's almost like it's a complementary element that we carry in ourselves. We always want to make sure we don't have too much prajna and not enough skillful means. We want to balance those out. We don't want to only have skillful means without the prajna, because then we don't really have the capacity to see through. We could solidify with too much skillful means, if you understand. Those are tools or talents or elements that we could master.
is one fundamental awareness and the other one cognitive, kind of cognitive to be able to work with these tools?
Yeah, it's basically finding the appropriate means to deal with situations.
Like the slogans.
Yeah, the slogans are going to help us do this. They introduce us to developing something called skillful means. And we're using our own very raw material, our own experience, to actually gain those skills through basically encountering our own rigidity and our territoriality and all of our me and mindness and all of the self-reference. This is the very thing that as it loosens up and as we discover the freedom that from that liberation, we actually develop skills in this process to be a benefit to others. Because this is the bodhisattva path. This is all about actually truly engaging with the world and being a benefit to the world and liberating the world and sentient beings.
Do you want to mention the last one?
Yes. So, okay. In post-meditation, one should remain a child of illusion. So, okay. So this actually kind of goes back to the first one of regarding all dharmas as dreams. I don't know. Did you read this part? I mean, you could, did you? I'd be interested to hear if anybody had any observations about that, or whether they had any questions about what that means. I mean, for me, one of the things that comes up is this lightening up process, which we actually is part of this regarding all dharmas and dreams. Begin to realize that everything is constantly dependent, mutually interdependent. Nothing arises by itself. Everything is it's almost like a house of cards that continuously is in a state of collapsing and rearranging, organizing, you know, developing, and then somehow exhausting, and then there's a new project or a new thing continuously over and over again. So this suggests flexibility, freeing up from solidity, and training in this by adopting the right view, and I have a note here, if we can maintain the perspective of absolute bodhicitta in meditation, even artificially, we will add a profound resonance to our relative bodhicitta practices. So in other words, we may need to just wing it for a while. It's not like, well, I can't do any of these other slogans until I get all this down, this absolute stuff down. We can just say, okay, I've been exposed to it. I'm getting introduced to it. And, you know, so I'm going to, like, almost just try to understand for myself, how I can apply it without assuming I really understand.
Would you say that this slogan, in post-meditation, be a child of illusion, would be, like, seeing the world fresh in every moment? That there's a quality of instead of laying concepts on everything and labels, that there's just sort of a wake quality to experiencing the world.
Well, I think that there was a corollary. It's more of a corollary of what you say. Mm. You begin when we talk about illusion, dream. You know, this oftentimes people talk about the East and the mystical East and everything's like smoking opium and, you know, kind of getting into the days and everything's cloudy and drifting off or, you know, with soft or zero edges. I mean, everything's just blending into everything else. That's not what this is about. It's actually just, we're playing. We're playing, the Japanese have this term, I play at doing this when they say they do something. I played it going to the movies or I played at work today. I played it, you know, working on a novel or I played it. This is how they describe this notion of the idea that somehow something, you're not really saying all this is real. Instead of, oh my God, I've worked so hard today, you know, I'm ready to collapse. I played it getting tired today because I played it really working hard or something. The whole notion of play.
So it says in post-meditation, which is an invitation to bring this out into all our experience doing all our whatever we're doing. Yeah. So it's this particular one, I think, is going off the cushion.
Off the cushion.
Yeah.
And you're coming out, and then you're beginning. If you really sit for a long time, in fact, the first time I ever did what was called a week tun, which was a, you know, 8-day sit from, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, I mean, it was a big shock to my system. But, you know, it was like, And I came out, and I was with some other people who had done it for the first time, too, and we were driving back. We were in the mountains, and we were driving back, and it was like suddenly like, where are we going? We're entering into this thing called the world, you know? And all like, uh-oh, you know, we're going to have to, like, start thinking like they do, you know, because there's this whole shift of feeling like, yeah, there's this game they're playing out there, and they're really serious about it. And, you know, when I get in there, I'm probably going to have to deal with that. So somehow, it could refer to that, too, of a sense of having a good meditation insight, suddenly you sort of rouse out and go, it's kind of like floating, or almost like semi-transparent. You know, it's like luminous, things brighten up, and the world is looser, and, you know, but you begin to see how we don't have to only do the things that our minds tell us, or everybody else is telling us to do, because this is how things are done, right? We can actually look at that. And we have that freedom. That's part of the freedom we're experiencing. It's a consequence of absolute bodhicitta. The consequence of flashing on this bodhicitta, establishing ourselves in it, and actually at that point, things lighten up and become less oppressive and less demand, you know, sort of absolute in their demanding. Yeah.
It seems like this is connecting to the prior group of lessons working with emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is really an instruction that's added, that illuminates working with emotions thing, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's why I like don't ponder others, because that's where I get hung up emotionally.
Uh-huh.
So that, do people memorize all 59 of those and then in their everyday lives go,
some are more important than others, okay? We're taking these first up through next week with the Relative Bodhicitta. This is the whole core of it, and we really have to master this, okay? Then towards the end, there's bundles of them, and you can take 2 minutes on each one for some of those. Huge one.
So with pondering others, this is what you would call, this has been your blind spot of where you get taken over.
Yeah, and I mean, it really connects you to.
But if you're really willing to work with these absolute slogans and just keep it simple, you'll find how you can just look at that when it comes up, and you'll begin to see how you can let it much. It's much more transparent. You'll start seeing through it. Oh, there it goes again. Oh, it's like a tape machine that goes over and over. You know, it's just, I know I'm finding a different face to put it on instead of the same person over and over. It's like I've got three or four new people to bring into the arena. But it's just, that's what absorbs my attention.
But there's something about these five ones that seems so esoteric.
It is esoteric. You are absolutely right. What does that mean? I want to give you, this is a wonderful word. Esoteric means there's a word, it comes from Greek, and it refers to, there's one thing called exoteric, and exoteric is, you need to understand first. Mm-hmm. Exoteric is the outer world, the trappings of conventional reality of what everybody agrees about. That's called exoteric. The laws, traditions, customs, all of those things are how we grow up, we're born into a family, they tell us how their structure of reality is, the universe, that's exoteric. Esoteric is something we discover inside us. This is something we learn directly from ourselves. It's an inner thing. It's an inner teaching.
Oh, I always thought esoteric is something that it's just out there.
No, but it's secret. It's secret because only you can know what you know.
Oh.
That's what it means.
That's what it means.
Can I mention next week? Okay. Are you finished?
I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
So next week we'll begin with slogan 7, Relative Bodhicitta, and we'll be doing 7 through 10. And I'll be teaching the practice of Tonglen, sending and taking. So there'll be an actual practice that you'll be instructed in, that you'll be able to take home and try at home. Michael will put it on the website.
I'll put the pages. You can easily find the pages.
It's the section in the book that refers to Tonglen and the relative Bodhicitta, slogan 7 through 10, so you can look that up.
And this is a very important instruction. Yeah.
So if anybody did not get a copy of this book and needs one, I have a few extra copies. Just looks like we're all good here. Okay.
Is that a trolley?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or no, this is kind of chosen.
But this one, if you have trouble getting this, let me know. I'll get you this as well. This is a wonderful book. I mean, they're both wonderful. But, I mean, I just, it was so delightful. Michael,
I know,
turned
Michael,
me on to this,
I know,
and I really appreciated it. Really helped me a lot in terms of being able to think about how I could present this teaching tonight.